What impact is IFRS 9 forward provisioning having on banks in light of recent guidance from regulators and the International Accounting Standards Board in relation to the COVID-19 pandemic? Welcome to the first podcast from Global Risk Regulator discussing the latest regulatory topics. With me today to discuss IFRS 9 is Jane Fuller, who is a co-director at the Centre for the Study of Financial Innovation. She is also a fellow at the CFA Institute UK. I also have with me Damien Burke, who is a partner at the credit risk consultancy Foremost. Now, just some quick background before we get started. IFRS 9 was introduced following the global financial crisis a decade ago in response to shortcomings of the previous incurred loss accounting model, which saw banks recognize too few of their bad loans too late. Regulators therefore decided that banks should instead provision ahead for potential future losses based on forecasting, the idea being that once these losses materialize, they would have the capital set aside to deal with them. IFRS 9 actually went live in most of the jurisdictions that recognize it in 2018. The economic and financial fallout from the COVID-19 pandemic is effectively the first major test for this new accounting standard. So, Jane, in terms of the banking sector, how do you think IFRS 9 is performing so far in light of the fallout from the pandemic? And have there been any unexpected outcomes from your point of view?
I suppose the easy answer is it's too soon to tell. And it'll be quite a long time before we know how it will play out in terms of mounting expected credit losses. I suppose with a couple of years of it, implementation behind us, you could say that at least the banks have been doing some more provisioning for expected losses under this model than they would have done under the incurred loss model. However, 2018, 2019 were still pretty benign years economically, and expectations are cyclical in the same way that loan losses are cyclical. So the banks looking ahead in 2018, 2019 would not have had a particular need to have significant expected loan loss provisions. So it's better than it was going into the financial crisis, but the amount of provisions built up was not that high. And of course, one of the many unprecedented things about COVID-19 is the speed with which it struck.
Yeah.
So now it's been a real 180-degree turn in the economic outlook, and the economic outlook's an important input into the models for expected credit loss models. However, it's so uncertain what the impact will be, and IFRS 9's not, it has some flexibility, so it's not automatic that if a payment's overdue for more than 30 days, you have to book a loan loss. So it's too early to say in that sense. However, obviously, we've started to see provisions be ratcheted up because of the change in the economic outlook. About $25 billion for the top half dozen banks in the US, and probably something similar in Europe.
Yeah, indeed. And Damien, what's your take on IFRS 9 performance so far? Has there been anything that's surprised you at all so far?
So I think there's been a number of surprises. I think, as Jane mentions, the actual speed of COVID-19's impact on the economy would have been unforeseen by anybody. Whilst most organisations have at least one downside scenario in their forward-looking scenarios, and some have an additional very severe one, I don't think anybody would have anticipated the severity and speed of COVID-19 and how it's affected businesses in the UK.
Yeah,
I think the other surprising thing is probably the regulator to it. In the last financial crisis, you know, it really was a financial crisis, and therefore that kind of flow of arrears and, you know, that kind of real world link between, for example, unemployment and arrears straight default meant that there was a certain level of certainty around the outcome, even if it wasn't necessarily wanted or expected. Yeah. Whereas under the kind of current situation, I think to some degree it's actually more uncertain, and I think banks are reacting in line with that.
Okay, and actually that takes us to the second question, and maybe Damien, you could start off with this one, answering it. So, you know, what do you make of the provisioning by banks during the first quarter? I mean, those results are pretty much out now. And what might that look like in the second quarter? I'm thinking in terms of maybe, you know, more loss provisioning, you know, loans in stage one moving to two or three. So, I mean, what's your view on that?
We've actually done quite a lot of work at Foremost to try and understand these outputs, both with our clients and more general industry view. And I think the one thing that's kind of clear is that, you know, generally banks have towed the line with the regulatory guidance and the guidance that's come out from likes of BIS, the IASB, and also the PRA, in terms of not necessarily moving cases directly to stage two, just because they've had a payment holiday, for example. And they seem to have focused more on how provisions are going to be hit by that economic outlook. Now, I think most banks have essentially suggested or have reported increases from December 19 to March 20 of around 20%, ranges from sort of 10 to 35. And most of that seems to be driven by, you know, changes to the economic outlook as a direct input to the models, or some level of overlay. I think our feeling is that there's probably more to come, because most of those impacts don't consider the effects that COVID-19 will have, and in terms of payment holidays and arrears, because that's been suppressed to some degree. And I think there's probably still quite a few things to work out in terms of elements of, you know, cure period. So once an account enters default under capital or impaired or stage three under IFRS 9. At what level could that order effectively or no longer be considered a default? Because those things will have quite significant impacts on both capital and impairment.
Okay. And Jane, I mean, you know, again, I mean, what's your view on, you know, what came out of banks and their first quarter results in terms of provisioning? What might that look like in the second quarter in terms of maybe, I don't know, more provisioning and, you know, loans being moved into different stages?
Yeah, I think, Lloyds Banking Group, for example, had a nice slide breaking down its increased impairment charge for the first quarter. The total charge was $1.4 billion, which was, you know, $1.1 billion higher than this time in 2019. As Damien said, the biggest thing was the updated economic outlook. But also one thing was the coronavirus having an impact on borrowers who were already undergoing restructuring. And so that's where you could say, well, you know, even without coronavirus, this company would be in problem. It would be in difficulties. So that's sort of easier. But I think that we're going to see fairly heavy provisioning continuing probably through this year. But one of the things that's changed since the end of March is that I think there was still quite a lot of hope then, and this is probably the message from regulators, that it would be a V-shaped recovery.
Yeah.
I think now it's looking more like a U-shape, a sort of fairly flat bottom. But it's still, again, sort of too early to tell. And I think regulators are very much saying, don't jump the gun, don't go over the top. And, of course, and bear in mind all the support that governments are giving to the both to the borrowers and, you know, in terms of liquidity to the banking system, and encouraging banks to keep companies, you know, not encourage. They don't want banks to starve companies of cash.
Yeah.
Companies that could well emerge healthy and healthy enough to repay the loan over its life. So it's still, you know, we've got this sort of everything's on freeze, but the economic outlook's deteriorating. So the second quarter will have to take some more account of that. One of the issues is bank profitability. So in the US, the likes of JP Morgan, were making very healthy profits in 2019.
Indeed,
so they can continue to take quite big provisions. But they're still making money. In Europe, it's where profitability has been much lower. It's, you know, in some cases, some of these losses will tip, some of these provisions will tip them into a loss. And that's where you've got to look at the capital base.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, you know, that's been strengthened considerably. You know, the sort of Basel reforms. Jane, maybe you could answer the next one as well. We'll start off anyway. Given the unprecedented nature of the COVID-19 crisis and a combination of very sharp economic declines, combined with unprecedented government central bank support, what challenges do you think this poses for banks when estimating expected credit losses and carrying out IFRS 9 provisioning?
Well, it creates a lot of uncertainty. You could say that the good news in that is that there's no point them putting what are always precise numbers into the accounts when there's a huge amount of uncertainty. So they'll obviously they're taking account of the obvious deterioration in the economic outlook, we don't know. They won't want to be running ahead of this and putting precise numbers on something, particularly precise numbers that might exaggerate it. Regulators are telling them not to do that. And the other thing is that, again, the unprecedented level of government support for borrowers means that it's very difficult to sort out the wheat from the chaff. So take payment holidays. You know, any business in its, you know, right mind is probably taking advantage of a payment holiday. That doesn't mean to say that not all of them could not afford to pay.
Yeah, very
true.
So
you're not going to immediately say, oh, you know, default, when they're just taking advantage of a holiday. And everything the regulators keep saying is, if the long-term outlook is that this company, this sector, whatever, is going to return to normal, then, you know, don't jump to conclusions, to very negative conclusions too soon.
Yeah. Okay, Damien, I mean, you know, what do you make of, you know, what banks are doing in terms of provisioning in, you know, and what are basically unprecedented, extremely unusual circumstances?
Yeah, so I think it's interesting around the kind of government intervention and obviously that of the regulator as well. And I think the, you know, the increase the extension of the furlough scheme is, you know, a kind of a critical measure in terms of how this is all going to play out. Because on the one hand, obviously it supports people and means that people are still able to maintain certainly some level of debt commitment, and also, you know, still contribute to the economy. Because I think the Bank of England issued not a forecast, an illustrative example last week that painted a potentially quite severe picture. But on the other hand, you know, that's not the only cost that businesses bear. So businesses obviously have to pay rates to some degree. And again, there's been some government support around that. Businesses have to pay rent relief, for their premises. They have to pay their suppliers. They're probably also suffering operational losses in terms of elements of their stock that is perishing or becoming obsolete or whatever else. So even with that support, I think there's another level of uncertainty on top.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it all leads to the kind of question of, you know, what is the right outcome, and what are the circumstances that have driven customers or businesses to seek this aid? You know, is it partially speculative, i.e. Yeah. they think they're going to be okay, but the money's on offer and it's a relatively low rate. So, for example, they could say, well, I'll take the payment holiday, and come the end of the month when they realise actually they've got very little else to spend their money on, that they decide to pay down the credit card, for example, versus somebody that has interacted with the lender in exactly the same way up front and said, you know, I need this payment holiday, but then actually extends their credit, so pays more on their credit card. But again, that's not the full story, because that person may have, you know, invested in an oyster, or, you know, put the mattress of money under the bed, or whatever else. So it's very, very difficult to tease out what these circumstances are, what the right approach is for exiting this, and crucially, what does it mean going forward? You know, what does it mean to, you know, effectively all of these models that banks have spent a lot of money to develop and use? You know, how does that mean that they're going to need to be adapted and changed over time to reflect a very, very unusual circumstance?
On the models, because we are getting, it's important that the disclosures here are important here. And so we're getting, you know, the base case economic scenario. So, for example, Lloyds was assuming 5% fall in GDP this year, but a severe economic case, you know, would generate 7 billion of expected credit losses. I think the danger is that, you know, actually just saying a 5% drop in GDP for 2020, is that now looking optimistic? And then, of course, there are the Bank of England and other central banks, of course, have been stress testing. So there's information in that as well. So I think it's important that they show their assumptions, and then you or I great ranks of analysts can look at it and think, oh, yeah, that looks as though it's conservative, realistic, optimistic, you know, and play around with their own models in terms of, you know, how things get worse.
And disclosures are always important, but I think you're dead right. I think this, and actually the results we've seen so far, there's actually been quite a lot of differentiation in terms of those assumptions, and also how those assumptions are relayed within the disclosures.
Okay, Jane. On to the next topic. IFRS 9 principles based. Firstly, how much leeway does that give banks in terms of how they can provision? And this is also quite an interesting one. There's been a little bit of criticism around this. You know, do you think there may be need for regulators to provide more precise guidance on how banks should provision, so to preserve clarity and comparability, which obviously is important, both to investors and regulators?
Well, I think it has provided flexibility. Otherwise, I think the prudential regulators would have jumped up and down and done something about it. And I think this is what encourages me that IFRS 9 will be okay through this, even though, as you said right at the beginning, it was designed to cope with the last crisis, which was to do with loans being recognised too late. So I think that I was just going to look at what ESMA had said on this. And they're constantly stressing the flexibility, the fact that you need to look out 2 to 3 years in terms of, you know, what might happen to the economy, how this particular borrower might perform, the level of government support. Don't forget, it's not just payment holidays. We're now getting one, you know, guarantees of loans as well from government. So the important thing, I think, is that IFRS 9's creating a forward-looking view. We are getting more interesting information through that, and we are getting earlier provisioning for loan losses. But it's a running theme, you know, and thank good. It's quite interesting that nobody at the moment is saying, oh, we should only have half-yearly reporting. We're all hanging on the quarterly yes. reporting now for updates.
Yeah. Yeah, well, now it's particularly important. Okay, and what's your view on principles-based provisioning and regulatory guidance so far, to in terms of clarity and sort of driving comparability between what different banks are doing?
I think comparability, and I shouldn't really say this as a CFA person, comparability can be overdone. It's actually quite important to be able to see, in these uncertain times, some of the different approaches that banks are taking. Of course, there's an overall attempt to start to quantify what impact COVID-19 will have on the loan book and on other asset prices. But reasonable people and actually rational models can differ on this. The model's very sensitive to some of the assumptions being put in, particularly on the economic outlook. So actually, I think so long as it's clear what the assumptions are, some of the differences will tell us something about the management of these banks.
Yeah.
And about the range of views.
So in terms of that kind of principles-based approach, I think it's absolutely right that it is. And I don't think anybody knows the internal workings of and quality of a bank's loan book better than the people that are managing it day to day. So I think they have to have the ability to make judgments, and that's very much part of IFRS 9, and make assumptions and also look at that forward-looking piece and not just understand the potential severity. Which would be in terms of the external severity, also the weighting in terms of the probability that that's going to happen, but then also the internal impact on their own loan book. So, for example, if you have two credit card portfolios and they sit exactly side by side, depending on that risk mix, and potentially geographic mix and all that sort of stuff, a rise in unemployment might mean something very, very different from portfolio A and portfolio B. So just having a standard approach to it, you could end up in a situation where actually you can't tease out the individual characteristics of those loan books and therefore the overall quality. And I think, as Jane mentioned before, potentially the comparability and how that kind of reflects on the management. Yeah. I know, Justin, one of the things we spoke about before, and this was the part of the implementation of IFRS 9, and also on stress testing as well, whether or not there should be a kind of a principle-based approach where organisations calculate their own ECL and disclosures and give all the information and advice around it that they possibly can, and that's their accounting treatment, that's the results they release,
right?
And also then have a very standard set of rules, almost like a generic industry-wide model, model in the loosest sense, that basically gives them a comparable set of accounts.
Yeah,
and actually, the use of two, I think, would be incredibly helpful for analysts, because I think some of the qualitative elements around the disclosures are quite difficult to tease out for analysts.
I think, maybe you could go into that a bit more detail a little later. I'd like to bring in Jane now for our last topic. So, let's imagine crisis has passed. What kind of revisions to IFRS 9, if at all, might be carried out by regulators? And maybe also, in what ways should banks maybe revisit their models for provisioning? Jane, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm hoping that they won't need to alter the accounting standard, that it will effectively have been stress tested and found to have sufficient flexibility, but that it will do its job, which is to make regulators, investors, analysts aware sooner of the potential scale of the losses. Okay. Although, of course, those could still be written back later. But that what that means is actually we perhaps ought to stop sort of obsessing with the accounting standards which are hitting the income statement and think a bit more about bank balance sheets. And I'm actually more concerned that the statement that's frequently trotted out, which is that banks are in much better shape going into this crisis than they were before the financial crisis, that is over-optimistic. Banks are still highly leveraged by many measures, particularly on a sort of gross leverage measure. And if you start to get serious impairments of assets because businesses really are going bust and there's no way of, it's not expected any longer, it really is a loss, then I think, and for example, we've seen some banks have been quite badly affected by the Singaporean trading, commodities trading company.
Yes, I saw that, yes.
So actually you're going to start to get those sorts of surprises as well, which actually quite quickly can hit the incur losses. So I'm a bit more worried if as this goes on and on, let's hope it doesn't, that actually you'll start to get more losses and that bank capital perhaps will be exposed as not being as strong as it should have been.
Or just get eroded, I guess.
Although, of course, buffers have been built up. So you do have buffers to be run down before you actually really get into the territory where they have to be refinanced.
Okay, and Damien, what's your take on the future of IFRS 9 and also bank models for provisioning?
I've got to say, just on that last point, I'm rather more optimistic in terms of how well banks are capitalised at the moment, and I think the buffers are doing exactly what they're supposed to be. I do agree on that kind of point, and I think that will be of particular importance to banks that have very kind of niche models and very niche markets, because even relatively good markets and good portfolios, if they're hit by a particular sector of the industry, could turn that bad very quickly, and that won't really be accounted for in the risk models per se, because nobody expected this to happen. I think in terms of the standard itself, I think the standard, to me, there is no need for revision.
Okay.
I think it's generally criticised for being too pro-cyclical.
Yes, I think
a lot of people have criticised it in light of what's happened recently. But I think that's actually more of an implementation issue. I think human nature very much focuses on what has happened in the past and what's happening now. We find it very, very difficult to look forward and account for good times or bad. So when things are bad, we tend to think things are going to be very, very bad and bad for a long time. When things are good,
sort of confirmation bias, isn't it?
Exactly. So I think whilst there were elements of downside going into this, which would already have been baked into the number, and therefore the increase should be smaller on the back of that, there should also be at the moment people looking forward and seeing the improvement in the economy, even if it is a U shape. There, for a mortgage certainly, and for some longer personal loans, that the life of those assets are going to go out beyond what our current view of that economic downturn looks like.
Yeah.
So therefore, at the back end of that, there should be improvement. So I think it's more about an implementation piece and trust the economics a little bit more and be a little bit broader in terms of what could happen. So not trying to pitch your tent in terms of this is exactly what's going to happen, but here's a number of scenarios that could happen that we need to account for.
Right. Okay. Well, on that note, I'd like to thank Jane and Damien for taking part in Global Risk Regulator's first regulatory podcast, and I'd like to wish everyone listening to stay safe and well. Thank you.